Three, two, one. Welcome to the show. I'm Chuck Anderson. I'll be your host for the rest of the hour. Thanks for being with us. We have a very interesting show for you today, and it deals with how many immigrants arrived in the Dakotas and throughout the Midwest and also part of Canada. With me at the Crossroads Hotel and Convention Center in downtown Huron is Ted Becker and his daughter, Corrine Becker. And Corrine is the conference chair of something that's very special that's going on here today. And Ted will be one of the speakers for a conference. Being here, and we're going to have Ted tell us all about it. And welcome to the show, Ted.
Thank you, Chuck. It's a pleasure to be here. And we appreciate the time that you're giving on your program to the history of our people from Russia. The Germans who immigrated here at the turn of the century. We appreciate the time you're giving us.
And thank you very much, for Corrine, for being with us.
Thank you, sir. I'm really happy to be here. This is the first time I've ever chaired this conference here in Huron, and I expect it's going to be a really good conference.
Tell us what you will be speaking on, Ted, and also your title. It's a fascinating title. National? International?
Well, titles are sometimes a dime a dozen, but I belong to two societies in the United States. One is called the Germans from Russia Heritage Society, whose offices are in Bismarck, and the other one is the American Historical Society of Germans from Russia in Lincoln, Nebraska. And the purpose of these two societies is to preserve the history of this group of people who migrated to the United States and to Canada, and incidentally also to Australia. We have some records from Australia. At the turn of the century from Russia, where they had lived for 100 or 150 years prior to that.
Let's have you give the address right now, because I know as this show unfurls and the people will see the content about what we're going to get involved with, they may want to be able to utilize your services. So Ted, if you would, you go ahead and give them the address. If through the show and they have German ancestry, they may say, hey, what was this guy's name and how can I get in touch with him?
Okay, I'd be glad to do that. First of all, these two societies, as I stated in the title, are Germans from Russia, not Germans from Germany, which is a distinction that we make. Not that we try to divorce ourselves from the Germans from Germany. The Germans from Russia Heritage Society in Bismarck is located at 1003 East Central Avenue, and the one in Lincoln, Nebraska, the American Historical Society of Germans from Russia, is located at 631 D Street in Lincoln, Nebraska.
This would be a good spot right now, Ted, to mention to the people the differences of the Germans from Germany that came over and the Germans from Russia, because we got involved in a religious persecution, and tell us about it.
Well, in the middle 1700s in Germany, a lot of the rulers were starting to put the screws, so to speak, to the peasants that were living there, and they just got fed up with the whole thing. They were also not given any land to grow their crops on and be farmers on, and the Russian government knew what was happening over there, and so they sent representatives into Germany, just like scouts, to convince these people that they should come to Russia and live because it's a better place to live. And a lot of them took them up on that. And part of the enticements were free land. Well, German people and Germans from Germany as well as Germans from Russia are very interesting. When you say free land, I mean, they're like ants to honey, because land to them is life. And so they took the Tsar and the government up on that free offer. But more importantly, what the government in Russia offered them was an opportunity to practice their religion without any interference from the government at all. And to them, that was paramount, because they were extremely religious people. And They moved then into Russia during the late 1700s and the early 1800s. And
what religious faiths are we talking about right here, Ted?
Primarily Lutheran and Catholic.
How about the Mennonites and Hutterites? Were they involved in this too?
They were also involved in that. I should mention, incidentally, that the Mennonites were actually the first ones to do the migration into Russia. They, of course, had stronger religious convictions. They also had a very strong feeling that the government should butt out of their religious business. And the Catholics and the Protestants, even in Germany, kind of tolerated the government butting into their business. But the Mennonites were different. They said, we don't want you guys to tell us what to do in our religious ceremonies at all. So if you went into Germany and Poland in the middle 1700s and saw these people in their villages, those are the towns that the government officials generally stayed out of. They very seldom went into them because the Mennonites felt so strongly about this separation between religion and government, church and state. So they were the first ones to move to Russia in 1762.
As a journalist, I have this natural question. We have Lutherans and Mennonites and Hutterites and other religious faiths that are making this mass exodus into Russia, partly because of persecution at home and partly because of the lure of free land in Russia. Why didn't all Russians leave? Why didn't suddenly that country empty out? Who stayed behind and why?
Well, interestingly enough, the ones that stayed behind were the ones that could not get out of the country. You see, you had to get permission to leave your village. And it doesn't mean that just tomorrow morning you take your family and pack up and go. It simply meant that you asked your boss, you asked your lord, you asked your master, you asked the government official if you could leave. The Russian representative would also petition the local government or whatever, asking if that you could leave. And it sometimes was a process that took years for these people to get out of Germany. Why didn't the country empty out? They had quotas. That's just natural, the same as we're talking today in trying to limit the immigration of people into the United States, quotas. And plus the fact that the German rulers were not about to let all their people skip the country because they wouldn't have anybody left to do the work, see.
So. Well, now it seemed like everything ran kind of smooth for about 100 years from 1762 until the Mennonites, who I understand were the first then to leave Russia about 100 years later. What happened then, 100 years later, to suddenly have all of these people who had once left Germany for Russia now want to leave Russia?
History repeats itself. You know that. You have an interest in history. And in their case, 1762, when the Mennonites settled in Russia along the Volga River, and around 1800 to 1810 and 12 in most other parts of Russia. Incidentally, 1812 is when Napoleon attempted to conquer Russia, and he had his famous march on Moscow, and during the winter, and all of these soldiers died, froze to death, and so forth.
Of which we have the 1812 overture.
That's right, by Tchaikovsky.
That's right.
That's correct. So two migrations into Russia, 1760s and the early 1800s. The 1800s associated with Napoleon's march on Moscow. These people lived in Russia for this period of time up until 1940. And in the early years, in the first 50, 75 years that they lived in that country, the Russian government lived up to its word with these foreigners that came to settle in their country. What they had promised them was a long list of things, but the main things were free land, although it never did come free. Religious freedom, the ability to practice their religion without any interference from the government at all. They also gave them some other enticements and inducements. One of them was they didn't have to pay taxes, which was a big thing. And one of the other larger things was that they were exempt from military service. Now, military service in Russia, if you entered the military, you signed up for a hitch, just like you do here in the United States. But their hitches were 25 years. Whereas in the United States, it's only 2 years.
25 years.
25-year hitch. So that was a very important thing to these young men, because if they didn't have to serve in the military, that gave them a chance to get their farms established, which is what they always wanted to do. Someplace in this 75 to 125-year period of time, the Russian people began to feel that everybody should be Russian. There shouldn't be any of this Germans and Norwegians, and everybody should be Russian. So we want everybody to start kowtowing to the Russian government. And what the Russian government says, that's what you should do, and nobody should have special favors. And they looked at all of these German villages around Russia, and there were thousands of them. What happened was these people were living a life the way they wanted to live, and the government was letting them do that. So animosity started, and Russian people started attacking the German people, and German people started defending themselves. And they started losing some of these privileges. The government started retracting some of those special privileges. And the Germans said, uh-oh, things are going to the dogs here again. We've got the same problem that we had back in Germany in the 1760s and the 1800s. Now what are we going to do? And
I think this is a good spot for us to stop right now. What are we going to do? Good question, Ted. My guest is Ted Becker and his lovely daughter, for whom we're going to have visit with us very shortly when we come back from a break. We want to remind everybody we'll be back in one moment. You're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson. Three, two, one. We're back. This is Chuck Anderson. My guest, Ted Becker, from North Dakota, and thanks for being with us, Ted, and his daughter, Corrine Becker. Corrine, it's a fascinating history that you have. I suspect a lot of us have fascinating histories if we only knew it, but you people have done a great deal of research to try to keep track of it. How do you feel about your background and your history?
Well, I think it's very important because just like the Germans who live in Russia currently, we are really struggling to maintain our identity as Germans. In the United States, it's so easy to become an American and to watch American TV and wear American clothing and eat American foods. It's the same with the Germans who live in Russia today. By societal pressure alone, they speak the Russian language, they eat the Russian foods, they wear the Russian clothing. It's very easy to lose the fact that we are and were a specific group of people, a hybrid of Germans and Russians. We have the German religion, the German customs, but we also have some of the Russian customs, the Russian foods that are incorporated, and they make us unique. And it's very hard being a young German Russian, and I mean by young, I mean anybody under 50 or 60 even these days, to be able to maintain that cultural identity, you know, to make the foods, to actually attend the church services in German. It's a struggle to actually keep that part of you separate and identify it kind of with pride, and to realize that, yeah, you know, I am special in this way. I'm still an American. I still, you know, I'm very proud of being an American, but there's something specific that sets you apart from the rest of the country.
Are you aware of how Stalin sold your people out to Adolf Hitler back in 1938. Now, I'm a history major, and I don't know where I missed this. Perhaps it wasn't in my college textbooks. I wasn't aware of how Hitler said, I want my people back, and made a deal. Are you aware of that deal?
Well, just because I study the culture and the history of the German Ocean people, I am aware of that. What happened was these people had led their lives so solitarily and so happily in their little villages. Nobody really talked about them. They didn't write a history down per se, and they pretty much got lost to the Americans who came to the United States, the German-Russian Americans. They had their relatives back in Russia. But, of course, history got lost when, you know, things got tough in Russia, when Stalin really put down his foot and said, this is the way it's going to be. Contacts were cut off between the Germans in the United States and the Germans in Russia. And silence pretty much just prevailed for 50 years until just now, when perestroika has come to effect and we've been able to go back in and talk to these people finally, because they'd been deported, sent to Siberia, left there to rot pretty much, live on their own, because they had wanted these Germans to become Russians. So if you separate them from the rest of their people, they are going to become Russians. If they're not with their group, they're not going to maintain those cultural ties. Well, the reason that I know about what's going on in the former Soviet Union at this time is I work at North Dakota State University on a project where we receive letters from the Germans inside of Russia. As Gorbachev came into power, he started to relax the restraints on these people. They were able to get letters out of the country where they had not been able to do that in the past 50, 60, 70 years. And they were able to actually receive letters now in the country that have not necessarily been unopened, because they do receive them open, but they're not censored, they're not destroyed. They used to receive empty envelopes, and sometimes they still do, but through this project I realize what's going on with the people in the former Soviet Union.
Well, Ted, this pact, you had explained it to me a little bit, and I was in complete awe. It goes back with Adolf Hitler and Joseph Stalin, and they actually initiated this thing in 1938 and really put the screws into it by 1940. Tell me more about this, because this is really fascinating, and perhaps some of our listeners aren't aware of how Stalin sold his own people out.
the world at that time was obviously in complete turmoil, and the leaders were grasping at straws, is what they were doing. Stalin was having a problem trying to figure out ways to defend himself, because he didn't trust Hitler, as nobody really should have or did. And he was trying to find ways to strengthen his hand, and one of the things that he felt would be important is if he had a buffer between Germany and Russia, a buffer of land, so to speak. Well, he knew that these Germans who had migrated to Russia in the previous 125 or 50 years were living all over the country, and he felt that if he took the land away from them, that could be his buffer, and it could also give him some time to build up his military. Hitler, on the other hand, felt that he needed more people. He needed people to run the factories and take care of the farms in these lands that he was taking over, Poland, Czechoslovakia, and so forth. And these people in Russia were the perfect people, because they were farmers in the first place, and they were proven industrious people. They could grow crops, and they could grow food, and that's what the government in Germany needed to continue to take care of its military machine. So Hitler and Stalin then signed this non-aggression pact, and I'm sure they had their fingers crossed behind their backs when they were signing the paper, saying that they would not attack each other and so forth. And in exchange for this agreement, Hitler would get these people who were Germans back, and Stalin would get the land. Stalin told the German people, when you leave, we'll sign a paper saying that we owe you so much money. If you've got 38 cows, we'll pay you for 38 cows. Just give me a little time to get the money together. Well, does that sound familiar or what? You know, dealing with the government and its promises. Not that I have anything against our government and its promises, but that's another story for another show. In 1940, this migration took place, and we have records that show generally when the people emptied out of each of the towns in Russia. Now, I am a research coordinator for these two societies, for the village that my mother's parents came from, and the village's name is Krasna, and it is located in what today is Moldavia, which is northwest of Odessa in the Ukraine. And on September the 26th, 1940, the people emptied out of Krasna. The population of Krasna at that time was about 1,100 or 1,200 people, and they were all Germans. There were no Russians living in the town whatsoever. And they left the town in a wagon train. I even have a picture of them leaving that town, and it looks like a wagon train on the plains of the American West. My daughter blew the picture up, and that's our heritage. That's our history. What they show in movies today in the United States, we have a similar history with our own people in Russia in 1940. And this period of 1940 and the migration was, as far as we can determine, the largest migration of people in recorded history, because the population of the Germans in Russia at that time is put at anywhere between 1.5 to 2.5 and 3 million people. A lot of our historians have done extensive research, and those are the numbers that they come up with. So for all intents and purposes, you can say that in 1940, in the fall, about 1.5 to 2 million people left their homes and migrated away, never to come back again. And it's a tremendous, moving thing to realize that that many people left their homes, and their people that were in their cemeteries, their grandpas and their grandmas in their graves, never to come back and never to see the graves and the graveyards and the homes and the churches and the buildings that they built and the dogs that they had and the chickens and the geese and the cattle and the horses, never to see that again. I have a great aunt who told me the story of when they left. And she showed me in the picture where she was sitting on one of the wagons. And it's a very moving thing to be able to see these people and hear what they went through. The government told them that they could take with them what they could haul on their wagon. Well, if you've seen these covered wagons, you don't have much room on those things. And if you've got 10 or 12 children, and all of the belongings for those 10 or 12 children, you don't have much room at all for belongings whatsoever. So I think that that would provide another story unto itself.
This is so fascinating, Ted. I've got to come back to you. I know I have other things arranged on the show, but this is really fascinating. We're going to be back in 1 minute. You're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson. 3, 2, 1. We're back. This is Chuck Anderson, my guest, most fascinating man, Ted Becker. Ted Becker's from North Dakota. He used to be a high school teacher, Latin and
English.
And English. Has been in insurance work since those years. Fascinating work. He's also a national and international coordinator for, and you tell us so that I don't get it mixed up.
Okay, I am a coordinator of research for one particular village in Russia. My purpose over the last 5 or 6 years has been to try to gather, just within my own office and my own storage areas, any and all information, political, religious, genealogical and whatever, for just this one village that my grandparents came from.
And your grandparents, were they Lutheran?
My grandparents were Catholic.
Were Catholic. Now, I didn't know that the Catholics were being persecuted. We mentioned the Lutherans and Mennonites and Hutterites, and we missed the Catholics.
Yeah, well, these people were peasants in Germany, but they were really, it didn't make any difference whether you were Catholic, Lutheran, or Mennonite.
Wow.
They were really persecuted and knocked down to become almost like animals. Often in the name of religion, and it didn't make any difference what religion it was. Most of the rulers in Germany in the 1700s, the reason that they were Catholic or Lutheran was political reasons, not so much religious reasons. So,
well, this group, before we took our break, Ted, we've left the fate of 1 to 3 million Germans up in the air. Joseph Stalin makes this wild deal with Adolf Hitler that I, frankly, was never aware of. He just sold all these people back to Hitler to be used in the factories. What happened to these people? Now we have this big mass migration by force back into Germany.
Well, they were put on to ships and trains and taken back into some of the countries that Hitler had conquered. Poland is a prime example. You can recall Hitler going into Poland and wiping out the country. Well, he needed to have people to live on those farms in Poland, and he needed to have people work in the factories. So what he would do is he would take the Polish people off their farms and out of the cities and put them in his factories in Germany and work them as slave labor and sometimes in the mines and so forth. And then he would put his German people on the land and make them do the farming. Well, that's all these people knew was farming. So they farmed that land. And in effect, they displaced the Polish people during this period of time, 1940 through 1942 and 43.
I might add for my listeners so that you can get a visual look at me right now. I am in absolute disbelief, and as Ted is saying this, I am shaking my head no. And this is very pathetic. And when you mention that the Germans were moved back to Germany in railroad cars, you know what came to mind when Hitler was also using those railroad cars for the Jews. But do continue. This is incredible, Ted.
Well, these people then lived in these areas along the eastern edges of Hitler's domain, Czechoslovakia, Austria, Germany, and so forth. And as the war began to turn in 1943 and the Russian government's army became stronger, they started coming west and getting some of those countries back. Well, we have a dilemma then, because these German people who were living on these farms were right in the path of the German or the Russian army. I have a relative in Germany that sent me a long written description of what happened to her during this period of time, and I can relate, you know, her personal incident. She was working on a farm with her mother and her children. Her husband was serving in the German army. And as the Russians began advancing into Poland, where she was living, she felt that they should head into Germany, get out of Poland and get into Germany. Maybe it would be safer there. So they packed up their belongings and literally walked along these roads back into Germany. And she said in her narrative that from day to day, all they could hear the guns behind them as they were heading to the east. They had problems, obviously, how to feed themselves, because this is a country that has people on the run. And how do you feed yourself? And it was not unusual to steal food wherever you could find it, steal it from other people that had it, and so forth. But the frightening thing, as they began to approach the sectors where the American armies were located, they're caught in between two advancing armies. And she tells that people were killed around her by American bombers dropping their bombs on these people. Obviously, the Americans didn't know that they were down there. But today, 50 years later, she still has tremendously hard feelings and bitterness within her for the fact that the Americans did that to these civilians. It's a difficult thing for her to relive, and it's a difficult thing all the way around, because to have to live in an area where a war is going on is difficult. We see it on television every day today.
Again, these are stories that I've never heard before. I've been a reporter for a long, long time, Ted, and usually if something's going on, I hear about it, and that's an interesting part of the war, too.
One of the interesting facets, too, is that some of these Germans that lived in these countries still felt that they wanted to go home, because Germany was not their home. Russia was their home. And so the Russian soldiers, as they were advancing, would take some of these Germans who came up to them and said, you know, I'm from Krasna, I'm from Landau, I'm from such and such in Russia, and that's my home. I'm a Russian citizen. And they were Russian citizens. I want to go back home. And so the Russians said, come on, you're welcome to come back. Well, they also said that with their fingers crossed behind their backs, because what they did is they didn't trust these Germans who were living in these areas who had been from Russia. They put them on trains and they shipped them right off to Siberia. And that we have recorded stories after recorded stories of these people going to Siberia, and some of them obviously not making it because they died on the way, or they were shot for insignificant reasons and so forth. The majority of the people that did survive were women and a few children, and we have stories of these women working in the forests and in the factories and in the mines over there, and they were the ones that played a large part in keeping the military going for the Russians during that period of time. So we have a splitting then of these two peoples, the ones that stayed in Germany and stayed ahead of the advancing army, and the other ones that went back into Russia.
Well, the ones staying ahead of the advancing army were getting bombed by the United States troops, and those trying to plead with the Russian soldiers to take them back, they had their fingers crossed and they're going to ship them off to Siberia. Actually, then the lucky ones, we're going to go back to 1862, were the ones that sort of had a feeling of what was happening, a turning point in Russian philosophy, and they said, hey, it's time to get out of here. The United States of America looked awfully good. You have some grandparents that came over?
Right. There were some people who, it sounds as if they had a lot of foresight, but really they didn't. What they had was, again, this hunger for free land. And we must realize that in the 1860s to the 1900s in the United States and in Canada and to some degree in Australia, these were developing lands. And the United States government said, we're going to have to try to settle this western part of the United States. The government in Ottawa said the same thing. We're going to have to settle that western part of Canada. How can we do it? We're going to open up homesteads and let these people come and live on this land, and we'll give it to them free. So what they did, with the help of the railroads, is send people representing their government to different countries, and one of the countries was Russia, and inviting these people to come to the United States, and you come over here and you can have this free land and you can practice your religion any way you want. We won't bug you at all. This is a free country, freedom to worship in any way that you see fit. And we'll give you a break on your taxes and things like this. Does this have a familiar...
Yes, I'm seeing it. That sounds pretty familiar.
So We have all kinds of written advertisements, pictures of things that were really attractive, showing all these beautiful valleys with trees and everything and water running in the little creeks to attract these people to come to the United States. And these people were afraid they were losing what they had in Russia, and so they said, hey, it's about time we got the heck out of here, and let's go and see what things are like over there. Some of them said, no, you guys are crazy. You're just like a bunch of people that want to just run around and don't want to settle down. But the ones that wanted to migrate said, we want to get over and get that free land and start lives of our own.
And this would be a good time to take a break as they got aboard the steamships in those days.
That's right.
And made some tracks coming over. We're going to be back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Personalities with Chuck Anderson. 3, 2, 1. We're back. This is Chuck Anderson, my guest, a very fascinating man, Ted Becker. And thanks again, Ted, for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure because we don't often have an opportunity to expand upon the history of our people and our heritage. So we owe you an awful great debt, Chuck, and I thank you very much for bringing me on.
Thank you, Ted. And I hope that our listeners are really enjoying the show, even just half as much as I am, because I'm finding this really fascinating. The Allied bombers bombing the German, the Russian soldiers take the... this is also fascinating. The pact that Stalin made to sell out his Russian people. Wow. Let's get to the turn of the century now. These are probably the lucky ones that started moving out of the European continent, heading for the United States, with a promise of free land and an opportunity to worship their God as they saw fit. Your what grandfather, Ted, came over? His name?
My grandfather's name was Jacob Becker. That is my father's father. And he came with his parents and family about 1910. They came through Canada, down through Portal, North Dakota, which was a common entry point into North Dakota.
And before the show, I didn't understand this either. You know, I'm really pretty dumb, Dad. I thought all of the immigrants came through Ellis Island, and I simply forgot many of them. 40% of the Germans went to Canada, which is pretty fascinating to start with. But coming in, if you went through the Canadian immigration authorities, you said they were a lot more lenient than the United States Customs at Ellis Island. So the Smart family would have come in through Canada and then down through the Dakotas.
That's generally believed to be correct. The Canadian government didn't ask as many questions, and they didn't do as thorough physical examinations of people as the American customs did in Ellis Island. There were, however, other places in the United States even that immigrants came into the country besides Ellis Island. As I said, all along the Canadian border, Portal at North Dakota, Galveston, Texas was another very popular and important place. Baltimore, Maryland was another. St. Albans in Vermont was another. So there were a lot of them along all of the seacoast.
And when they got into the United States, no matter how they came, either through Canada or through the eastern seaports or Texas, didn't realize that either, Ted. When they became residents and got a hold of this free land, I found that very fascinating when you said when a stranger came on the farm or into their home, what did Dad say? We aren't going to speak German, right?
No. My father related the story that as children, they were told that if anyone came onto the farm that was non-German, that they would, number one, speak damn little, and number two, speak only in English, because they didn't have anything to say. They're kids, and you just stand over in the corner and be quiet.
They were told to say yes or no.
They were told to say yes or no, and that was it. You did not embellish your answer beyond yes or no.
My wife came. You know what I says when we were having coffee? I think I'm beginning to understand my wife a lot better now. When this was the closed lip philosophy that they were taught. Everything was, because I always joke, you know, I says, I'll ask my wife, do you have the time? And she says, yes. And I might wait 2 or 3 days until finally I say, "What time is it?" She did answer the question. She does have the time. The tightness of the family, this is just amazing as they came to the United States. I can't, quite frankly, visualize the strength that it must have taken these people. You said, you had mentioned Joe's Law. Let's talk about that.
You need to understand that when pioneers, let's call them pioneers, enter a new country, that survival of them and their families is dependent upon them being strong. They have to endure everything. They're poor. They have little or nothing. They don't have a roof over their head. They're living in these sod houses and so forth. And generally, in that type of environment and situation, you need one strong individual who makes the decisions. In the Mennonite areas, there was generally the elders of the church who were the strong individuals. Out here on the plains of North and South Dakota, specifically around Eureka, South Dakota, and Strasburg, North Dakota, in the 1890s, 1880s.
That was even before Lawrence Welk was born then.
Not much before that.
That's right.
Pretty close.
Pretty close.
The people would live out in the middle of no place. And if Dad said, "Ted, you go and you build a fence along that stretch over there, and you build it straight, because the way I taught you," I would go and do that. Now, if there was a tree standing right in the middle of this place where the fence was going, and I made the decision to go around the tree with that fence, and then he came out and saw that, needless to say, my such and such would be in a ringer. I would be in deep doo-doo because I didn't do what he told me to do, even though mine made more sense and mine was probably more correct than his. I didn't build that fence straight. I went around the tree. As far as he was concerned, I should have moved the tree and built it straight. So if I didn't do it his way, then I was violating a very definite principle, and that was that he was the head and you obeyed what he said and you did what he told you to do. You did not do any thinking for yourself. These people brought that same ethic from Russia. They had very strong paternal governances. The father ruled the house, literally. And we do not find in a lot of our records much reference to the women. We can see their first names, but we never know their last names. If a daughter died, it was often not even recorded because women were not anything more than just a piece of property. Now, I'm not saying we should have that today, but there might be a few of the old timers that feel we should still go back to that, but that's another story again, too, you know. So doing it Joe's way was the only way, even though you needed to probably use a little common sense. That's just the way these people were. And I can understand your wife and where she's coming from, and I think she's a great lady, and she's an angel for putting up with you all these years, I might add. So,
you know, speaking of my wife, Wanda, I want to mention a story that I hope that you'll be able to pass on, and maybe we can somehow get some collaboration down in the years past. If you have a chance at a conference, do feel free to pass on the story, because after all, it is public. We're putting it on the radio right now.
Sure.
My mother-in-law's name is Hulda Kaplan, and she was originally a Wagner, which we would say Wagner, from Elchin. Am I saying Elchin right?
Elchin,
it's actually
right.
Elgin, but it's Elchin.
Do you know what a crotch is?
No.
A crotch is where Lawrence Welk parks his Dutch.
Well, my mother-in-law, Hulda, came from the old country with her parents in about 1907, 1908, landed at Ellis Island, and there was some real poverty things that happened to them because, number one, before they got out of France and into England, they found out that their trunks were either stolen or missing. They have no idea what happened to them. They landed in England with virtually the clothes that they were wearing, and that was it. I mean, this was tragic. They had their ship ticket yet. So they continued on to Ellis Island in complete poverty, no money. And as they are taken through and that gate is open to them and they're looking out to that big, beautiful city of New York City, they have nothing. They have no money whatsoever. The first people that approached them were gypsies asking if they had any children for sale. Now, Hulda's younger brother was blonde and blue-eyed, and he was worth $100. The gypsies would have paid him, the parents, $100. Now, Ted, we just can't visualize in this day and age what $100 meant to anyone. That would have paid your railroad fare, everything out to the Dakotas, or you could have bought a farm.
Well, I think that we can equate that, though, to today. Because you watch television and you read the newspapers, and you can still read and hear about the selling of children, which is a tremendous tragedy. But there are always two sides to a lot of these stories, and I don't condone the selling of children, but in that period of time when they came off the boat and had nothing and somebody said, here's $100, you give us your child, we can't speak for how we would have reacted at that time, much less try to judge what these people might have done. Whether those incidents actually happened or not is anybody's guess. But you can pretty much guess that they might have happened because they're happening today.
That's right.
And that's the frightening thing.
Well, the happy ending to the Kaplan Wagner, yes, they didn't sell the children, but they knew of many people that did, and there's the tragedy.
That's the tragedy.
And the tragedy for me right now on my fourth segment, Ted Becker from North Dakota. And where are you living at right now, Ted?
I live in Williston in the northwestern corner of the state.
My tragedy is I've run out of time. And I know when I visit with a guest that I enjoy so much, it's hard to break away. But we have to because we've got the news coming up in about a minute away. I want to thank you, Ted Becker, for being with us, and I hope that our cross will pass again, and maybe will you be on the show again sometime?
Well, I hope that sometime we can be again, and feel free to call at any time, and we can talk some more. This history is a fantastic, interesting thing, and we're very proud of who we are, even though we've had a tough history, and we're just more than happy to share it with people just so that they know that there may be a part of history that was not recorded, and we're trying to correct that situation. So thank you very much for allowing me to speak.
Your address again in Bismarck, just very quick.
1003 East Central Avenue in Bismarck, the Germans from Russia Heritage Society.
Ted, thank you so very much for being with us. I just can't tell you how much I've learned about part of the people who settled the Dakotas and Minnesota. As I mentioned earlier in the show, we did have other guests that we wanted to get on today's show, but you were so interesting, Ted, we decided to stay with you, and we will have those other guests on next week for part two. One of our guests next week will be Dr. Timothy Cloverdance, professor of anthropology and folklore at North Dakota State University, who, by the way, was doing research in the Soviet Union 4 years ago when the government began to disintegrate. That in itself is a fascinating story. Another guest will be Dr. Harry Delker, a retired psychologist from the staff of the University of Wisconsin. It's an interesting show, and one I hope you'll take time to tune us in next Saturday morning at 10:05. Until next week, this is Chuck Anderson saying thank you for listening. Have a great and successful week.